Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 2016 National Zero Mental Health Symposium gets underway today in Tulsa, and today over 1,000 mental health, addiction, and homelessness experts and professionals are gathering to hear about the latest efforts to provide housing to the homeless, along with clinical and recovery breakthroughs. The main focus of the three-day event is in moving the homeless rate down towards zero. This has been a long goal for mental health professionals and homelessness experts. My guest today has been in the forefront of this movement. Jeff Olivet is the president and CEO for the Center for Social Innovation in Massachusetts. He's a national leader on homelessness, poverty, affordable housing, and behavioral and public health. And all of these subjects are key to reducing the long-term homelessness rate. But he says one key aspect is not being spoken about, the issue of race in homelessness. The national population of long-term homeless is heavily overrepresented by African Americans and Native Americans, even taking the higher poverty rates for these groups into account. His Center of Social Innovation has launched SPARK, Supporting Partnerships for Anti-Racist Communities. And it's a multiple city effort to seriously research why these populations are overrepresented in homeless statistics, and then devise and implement strategies to remove the disparities and lower the overall homeless numbers. Jeff Olivet will be a featured speaker throughout the three-day event, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Jeff Olivet, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rich.
You've written that when we discuss the root causes of homelessness, experts will often talk about poverty. They'll talk about substance abuse as a part of a component of homelessness. They'll talk about health care and mental health especially. But rarely will experts talk about race and racism. And you say this is an important part of the conversation. Why is it an important part of the conversation for persistent homelessness?
I think, you know, people zero in on the individual vulnerabilities that make people susceptible to homelessness. And what I mean by that is when you say the word homeless, people often have a very stereotypical picture in their mind of somebody with substance use problems and mental health problems and, you know, living outside and panhandling with a cardboard sign. And certainly there's some truth behind those stereotypes, like with all stereotypes. But what people rarely do in the general public, I mean, is really think about the root causes. And when we talk about root causes, we're thinking about things like lack of affordable housing broadly, lack of income equality, and institutional racism. And that last of those things I just mentioned, institutional racism, is intimately connected to homelessness, and yet there's been radio silence around the question of race as it pertains to homelessness.
And how does it relate to homelessness, the institutional part of it? Is it a matter of you can't find affordable housing and there's still a racial component to where the establishment and real estate is going to let affordable housing go in? What is it exactly?
Certainly, lack of access to affordable housing is a piece of it, but let me just sort of step back for a second and talk about the numbers. What we see nationally is, for African Americans in particular and Native Americans in particular, we see dramatically higher risk of homelessness, even when you control for poverty. So to be concrete, African Americans are about 14% of the national population generally. They comprise about 27% of the poverty population, and yet when we look at people experiencing homelessness, African Americans make up more than 40%. So there's something else going on here. It's not just matched with the poverty stats, for example. It's there's a bigger proportion of people of color who are homeless as compared to their white peers, even when you take poverty into consideration.
What about Native American, Latino populations, other groups that often are at odds in racist situations? Do they see similar increased numbers beyond, say, the people in poverty and their percentage of the population as a part of the homeless population?
Similar, but not quite as high. African Americans are the most overly represented in the homeless population. The only other group that comes close is Native Americans. And Native American prevalence of homelessness is about 2-to-1 compared to their white counterparts. There's a dilemma around Latino homelessness, around really understanding it. And what I mean by that is we think that the current methodologies for counting, for looking at the number of people literally homeless on a given night, for example, which is the predominant national way of estimating homelessness, leaves out a whole bunch of people who are not coming in for services. So it's likely to dramatically undercount the number of undocumented immigrants, for example, who would be experiencing homelessness, or migrant farm workers, or people who are simply not coming in for services because those services aren't culturally and linguistically appropriate, or because they're living in fear of deportation if they do come in.
So why do we think that there's disproportionately more African Americans that are homeless than, say, they should be by poverty rates, by their proportion of the national population? What is your best guess, or have we been doing research on this question?
The research is in its infancy, and so I think there's been a lot of research over the last 3 or 4 decades that has documented this disproportionality. There's been very little that has analyzed why or suggested solutions for what we can do about it. But our best thinking is that overt and covert discrimination in housing, in employment, and in criminal justice lead directly to high rates of African-American homelessness. So we know that there's a pipeline of people from jails and prisons into homelessness. And if African-Americans and African-American men in particular are more likely to be incarcerated, then there's a logical progression of thought that would say people reentering from the criminal justice system are also likely to be disproportionately African-American and Latino and other people of color. You could look at the same kinds of trends around housing and jobs discrimination. There's been a lot of research on the lack of units that people of color are shown compared to whites. There's good data on people with ethnic-sounding names, with names that sound more African-American than white, not being called in for a job interview, where the study has literally used the same resume, and the person with the black-sounding
wow.
name doesn't get called in, and the person with the white-sounding name does.
Let me focus on that criminal justice aspect. We do know that African-American incarceration rates are disproportionately high, especially for men. When a person gets out of prison, they have to find shelter. How often does that lead to homelessness? And if you compound it with the difficulty in getting a job normally, getting a job with a conviction on their record, how difficult is it to keep someone out of homelessness when they are released from a jail or prison?
I think you're really onto something there. It's hard enough for people to, for poor people and people of color to find a job, to find housing, to find opportunities. When you compound that with a felony conviction or a history of incarceration or criminal justice involvement, it becomes a deck that is tremendously stacked against that entire group of people and creates the circumstances in which homelessness is much more likely to happen, and it becomes that much more difficult for people to exit homelessness. So we're interested in trying to understand the pathways into homelessness for people of color, but also the barriers to exit homelessness for people of color.
Staying on the criminal justice path, I'm wondering how the regulations and restrictions on where certain ex-cons can live if they're convicted of what are often called sexual crimes, and it can be anything from public urination to, you know, all sorts of things that fall under that rubric, which limits their places to live upon release. Does that figure into this homelessness question much?
It figures into the homelessness question. I'm not sure that it figures into the race and homelessness question.
Yeah.
I've not seen any research that documents higher rates of sexual offenders who are people of color in the homeless population. What we do know is that registered sex offenders often end up homeless because there are simply no places they can legally live within a jurisdiction. And so they end up being off the grid, which I don't think is great for anybody from a public health and public safety standpoint. For people of color, I think the question of incarceration and criminal justice involvement more broadly, the kind of so-called sexual crimes aside, is profoundly connected to the experience of homelessness. And I would take that a slightly different direction and say that as our country takes on prison reform and begins shrinking the size of the population who's incarcerated, we have to prepare for that in terms of housing and jobs and community supports, or we're going to see a massive new wave of people experiencing homelessness, many of whom will be people of color. It will be akin to when we closed down the back wards of the state mental hospitals and saw this massive wave of people who had formerly been institutionalized who were now homeless on the streets of America in the late 70s and early 80s and even persisting until today. And I'm not sure we're ready for that wave. I'm not sure we're thinking through the unintended consequences of de-incarceration, which I think is the right thing to do, by the way. I think
right.
It's important that we reduce the prison population, particularly those who have petty crimes and low-level drug crimes and that sort of thing. But we have to be ready for the unintended consequence of increased homelessness.
Well, criminal justice reform has been going on in a number of states for a number of years, and I know from the overall national homelessness statistics, we've seen a slow decline, but in some states you're seeing declines, other states you're seeing increases. Is there any correlation between criminal justice reform, where you're reducing state prison populations and homelessness and the homelessness rates so far already?
I'm not sure we know yet.
No.
I think I want to challenge one thing, and that's that, you know, we are seeing the literal homelessness count numbers, the point in time count numbers, decrease slightly every year, and that's been, you know, a slight downward tick of a couple of, you know, 2% a year, that sort of thing. I think maybe 11% since 2007. If you just simply run those numbers out, if you take them at face value and run them out, it would take us several decades to end homelessness as we know it now.
I think you wrote something about 2069 was.
I did the back of an envelope calculation on how long it would take us at decreasing homelessness by 2% a year, and I came to 2069 as the year we would finally end homelessness. I also think that those numbers are only part of the picture, and what I mean by that is the point in time count methodologies literally count people who are on the street, in the shelter, in transitional housing on a given night in January. What they don't do is take into account people who are not found that night. They don't take into account people who become homeless over the course of a year or who are in and out of homelessness. And so it's one data point. And what the folks who espouse the point in time counts will say is, at least you're comparing apples to apples from one year to the next. And that's fine, but it's a limited methodology and comes nowhere close to estimating the true scope of homelessness over the course of a year, much less over the course of people's lifetimes.
And I assume you're also looking at places where you expect to find homeless people, and the whole thing is, if you take time in your a weekly commuting and actually search for people who are living on the street, you'll be surprised at where you'll find people living on the street. I mean, they're underneath trees in the median of an expressway, under bridge girders, you know, all sorts of places. And I just can't imagine that a one-night survey is going to get you an accurate account of who's on the streets.
That's right. And we've also seen the emergence of tent cities and communities all over the country since the Great Recession in a way that I don't believe we've seen since the Great Depression several decades ago. And I agree that our counting system is limited and only a part of the picture. The other thing that I would say is that we can have great success in ending homelessness at the individual level, and we do. We see incredible programs in Tulsa and all over the country that are doing great work around housing first and supportive services and getting people the support they need to be successful in housing. What we're not doing is turning off the faucet that is causing homelessness to begin with. And we talked earlier about incarceration, but you could also look at youth transitioning from foster care directly into homelessness. You could look at families who are living on the edge, paycheck to paycheck, or doubled or tripled up with family and friends. We're not doing enough to prevent homelessness in the first place. And if we don't figure out the prevention side of this equation, we can end homelessness all we want, and we'll never end homelessness.
Can we talk a little bit about youth transitioning from foster home care? I mean, from everything I read, it's the system does very little for that youth once he turns 18, he or she turns 18. It's the foster home is no longer receiving payments. They're pretty much on their own. What sort of assistance does the state actually give to these youths when they age out of foster care?
it's a really important group for us to pay attention to and look at. And thankfully, there's been an increasing awareness nationally about the needs of homeless youth. The one thing that I'd like to point out is that about 40% of homeless youth identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. And looking at that population alone, we're talking about extremely vulnerable young people who have often been marginalized by their family and their faith community and their friends. And you compound that with histories of abuse and child welfare involvement and foster care. We're talking about a population that is in incredible need and at incredible risk of trauma and violence and sexual exploitation. And we've got to do more to support these kids. And I think that responsibility is a state and local responsibility. I think it's a federal responsibility. I think it's a family and community and faith community responsibility. And it feels like we're just now, as a nation, beginning to recognize and respond to the problem of youth homelessness. There's some really exciting work going on with an initiative called Away Home America that's working in a number of cities with 100-day challenges on ending youth homelessness. And that's been a really exciting movement to see take off. And I would encourage folks to find out more about Away Home America and see what you can do in Tulsa and across Oklahoma.
Getting back to the question of what assistance provided, is it mainly private institutions, nonprofit institutions that are helping these kids in transition? Are states, localities helping many of these kids once they age out of foster care?
It's hard for me to generalize, but maybe I'll do it anyway.
Okay,
I think generally states see their responsibility as ending when the young person ages out of the child welfare and foster care system. And so that age may vary state by state, but on the person's 18th birthday, for example, they are really out on their own, and the state no longer has a legal or fiduciary responsibility to that young person. You compound that with mental health issues that might be emerging in that age group. We certainly see first episodes of psychosis, schizophrenia, other mental illnesses emerging at that age. We see young people using and abusing substances, and often that's to cope with past trauma. And, you know, you sort of combine all of that with a lack of a safety net that, you know, maybe was there before they aged out, and all of a sudden the next day there really is nothing for them. And what we're talking about then is the nonprofit health and human services safety net providers. And there's been very little emphasis on housing and school and jobs opportunities and things like that for these young people. So I do think the burden has fallen on the nonprofit sector, and that sector hasn't figured out on a large enough scale how to meet the needs of these young people. That's not to say that there aren't some good programs going on. There certainly are, but we still see youth homelessness on an unacceptably large scale across the United States.
My guest today is Jeff Olivet, the president and CEO of the Center for Social Innovation. He's a national leader on homelessness, poverty, affordable housing, behavioral health, public health, and he will be a guest of the National Zero Mental Health Symposium this week, and specifically talking about the role of race in homelessness. And, you know, as you talk about, I was just sitting there as you were talking about, you know, this transition for kids coming out of a foster home system, I'm thinking about prisoners leaving prison. Do states and the federal government maybe have a bigger role in transition for anybody who has been under government supervision in one way or another? When they leave that government supervision, should that be an increased role for state governments and to ensure that these folks that are coming out of state supervision for whatever reason, through no fault of their own or through incarceration, sort of have a smoother runway back into society?
I think that what we're seeing is a breakdown of these systems, and systems that see themselves as isolated from all the other systems. So when I got into homelessness work more than two decades ago, I thought it was an isolated social issue. And what became eminently clear to me early on was that homelessness is just a symptom of everything else that's broken. And so some of the broken transitions that you just talked about are indicative of that. And what we need to do is figure out better transitions at those moments of vulnerability when people are moving from hospitalization out into the community if they've got severe mental illness, or from incarceration into housing and making sure that that transition happens well, as opposed to people ending up on the street. Foster care the same way. We talked about that a few minutes ago. Now, whose responsibility that is, people will debate across the political spectrum.
Right.
I believe that it's all of our responsibility, and that the federal government and state governments can show great leadership and target resources in that area. I think the business community and the faith community can step up and really think about how to provide job opportunities and community supports and financial resources for folks. I think the nonprofit sector has a huge role to play. I think housing developers and housing providers can really focus affordable housing opportunities for these particularly vulnerable populations. There are also very good transitional case management models. One that comes to mind in particular is critical time intervention, or CTI, which was designed explicitly for this purpose that you talked about, Rich, where people are at a vulnerable moment of transition from jail to community or from psychiatric institution back out into housing. And what CTI does is provide a bridge of support and connection across the transition itself and in the months to follow, as the broader community kind of picks up responsibility for supporting and reintegrating people into the community.
You know, you were talking about this critical time intervention, and certainly when people are released from prison, you know, one of the main pieces of advice, say if you're in for some sort of drug offense, is to sever the ties with the environment that led you to the drug use in particular. And I could really see where that ends up in homelessness. If you're unable to find a job almost immediately, if you've severed all your ties with this environment that led you to using substances, illegal substances, then you know, I could see where you could very well easily be homeless very quickly.
And the housing options that are available to poor people are so limited, and often in the roughest parts of town, which put them right in the face of former drug dealers and people they were using with, and abusive partners, and all of these other sort of high-risk relationships. And so it's no wonder that people often relapse and often struggle for sobriety and for stability.
Through our conversation today, we've talked about a lot of different approaches, and you know, Housing First has been one that's certainly been touted here in Tulsa, and it seems to have had some effect. But I was struck by something you said. We really have to turn off the faucet. How are we doing? Are there any sort of programs that are doing good work in turning off that faucet of this sort of continuing population who are coming into homelessness circumstances?
It's a really good question. I think that's the big one. Just to comment on Housing First, before I talk about prevention, the idea of Housing First has been really transformative in our collective response to addressing homelessness. It starts with the premise that housing is a basic human right and should not be contingent upon programmatic requirements or sobriety requirements or things like that. So it's basically saying that housing is a stable jumping-off point for health and connection and employment and stability and parenting and everything else. So that's been just an incredible innovation over the last couple of decades.
I love the fact that you use the word stable, you know, the stability, because that's sort of, isn't that the key to the program? It's like, here's your first stable element. You have a place to stay. You have a roof over your head.
That's right.
Now you can work on other issues.
Two decades ago was get sober and then you'll earn housing. Go see the psychiatrist and take care of your mental health condition, and then you can be stable enough to deserve housing. What Housing First has done is flip that on its head and say, how could you possibly get sober, get stabilized, get healthy, get a job, get to work, keep your kids in the same school, if you don't have housing as that stable platform from which to heal and reconnect? Now, to your question about prevention, is anyone doing anything on that? I'm sure, at the local level, there are some small eviction prevention pools of money and that sort of thing, but too often we've not done anything on prevention. And what we've done is wait till people end up in the homelessness system and then say, how can we most quickly get them back into housing and in the community? And in some ways, we we intervene too late. And so I don't think there's a good science. I don't think there's a good toolkit on how to identify who's at most risk for homelessness and intervene at the right time to prevent that in the first place. I really think that's the new frontier of homelessness policy and practice and research.
Well, my guest today is Jeff Olivet. He will be a guest of the National Zero Mental Health Symposium this week. He's the president and CEO of the Center for Social Innovation in Massachusetts. What's the program you're most excited about from your own Center for Social Innovation?
We've got some wonderful stuff going on. I don't even know where to start. But what I think I'll pick off is a national project that we've initiated on racism and homelessness. And we call the project SPARC. It stands for Supporting Partnerships for Anti-Racist Communities. And we're working with 10 communities across the country to understand the dimensions and the scope of racial disproportionality in the homeless population, but also take action on how to begin chipping away at that problem. And in the process, we're collecting 200 life histories of people of color who have experienced homelessness so that we can understand the trends and the problems and the pathways into and barriers out of homelessness. We're also working with multiracial teams in each of those communities to begin to come up with solutions. So I think if I have the chance to talk with you again in a year or two, Rich, I'll have a lot more to share on where that project is and what we've learned, but I think it's going to be a real spearhead for change in communities across the United States.
Are you still in the information gathering mode at this point?
We are. In fact, we just launched that project in July of this year, and so we are very much in the information gathering and mobilizing teams to take action mode. The project runs through summer of 2017, and I should say that it's funded very generously by the Oak Foundation and a number of other groups who have supported that work in the 10 communities.
Now, these 10 communities, do they buy into this issue that they have to address race to solve their homelessness issues?
The project is explicitly about the intersection of racism and homelessness, and we carefully use the word racism and use terms like racial equity as
there
opposed
we go.
To
mm-hmm.
Talking in euphemisms and sugar-coated terms.
Yeah. Well, we wish you great success. Have you learned anything yet already that sort of is sort of turning on a light bulb for a possible solution?
The most exciting thing has been simply the receptivity of people in communities across the country, north, south, east, west, in the middle, ready to talk about this, ready to have the conversation, ready to come together to address it. And, you know, it's like there's been this big national conversation about race and racism, which we see playing out in the protests this week in Tulsa and in Charlotte and in communities around the country. That's a conversation about race. And over here, separate from that, we have a national conversation about homelessness. What we're trying to do is bring those two conversations together.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with that. Look forward to your appearance at the Zero Symposium this week. Jeff Olivet, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Jeff Olivet is the CEO and president of the Center for Social Innovations in Massachusetts, a national leader on homelessness, poverty, affordable housing, behavioral health, and public health. He'll be a guest of the National Zero Symposium on Mental Health, which gets underway today at the Cox Business Center. If you'd like more information on the symposium, visit zerosymposium.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.